from NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In the theater of presidential debates, every candidate tries to find that one lasting moment. And for Ohio Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan, it might have been this exchange with Senator Bernie Sanders.
What do you do with an industry that knowingly, for billions of dollars in short-term profits, is destroying this planet? I say that is criminal activity that cannot be allowed to continue.
Thank you, Senator Sanders. Congressman, your response.
Well, yeah, I would just say, I didn't say we couldn't get there till 2040, Bernie. You don't have to yell.
You don't have to yell. Well, that might be Congressman Ryan telling his fellow Democrats that cooler heads must prevail in 2020. But who is listening to his message? Ryan isn't polling over 1%, but can he break through? Well, today he's here and he'll take your questions. So this hour on Point, Congressman Tim Ryan and his run for the White House. And you can join us. What is your question for the congressman about guns, about the economy? When he says that the healthcare system needs a public option before moving towards full Medicare for all, does that sound pragmatic to you or timid? Join us anytime online at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio, or of course at our website, onpointradio.org. And a little later this hour, we'll also be taking a look at the high-tech and low-tech ways people are trying to thwart facial recognition technology in the Hong Kong protests. But first, let's spend a considerable amount of time here with Congressman Tim Ryan. He joins us in the studio. He's serving his eighth term as representative for Ohio's 13th. Congressman Ryan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's ask you the question here. How much longer are you going to stay in this race?
We're in it for the foreseeable future. We're picking up support. I was just in New Hampshire yesterday. After I got done speaking, four or five people came up. They want to volunteer on the campaign, help us in New Hampshire. We get standing ovations everywhere we go, whether it's South Carolina, teachers' unions. So we're connecting and we're just building it out. I mean, I don't have the name recognition, which is why I'm glad you're having me on right now, that some of the other candidates. And when you look at the polling, it says, who, if you had to vote tomorrow, who right. would you vote for? And then someone has to say who they're going to vote for. But behind that is, how certain are you that that's your candidate? And about 60 to 70% of the people are saying, I'm not certain at all of who okay. I'm voting for. So it's wide open.
So this is the funny thing about presidential politics in this day and age, because on the one hand, you have the all-important face-to-face retail politics in those early primary states,
yeah.
right? So everyone goes to New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina. And maybe you're making – maybe you're getting some traction there. Understood. But you said it yourself. There's a name recognition issue, and that's mm-hmm. what makes those that debate stage really, really important. And
yeah.
you may not make it
yeah.
to that next debate on September 12th, because your numbers have to be up over 2%. You got to
right.
you got to double those national numbers. How are you going to do that?
Well, continue to work. I mean, we went from zero. We've been spending some time in South Carolina. We went from 0% to 1% in South Carolina. We've had significant. We've picked up a couple of really key endorsements down there. Representative Fletcher Smith, Brandon Brown. These were Vice President Joe Biden's co-chairs. Representative Smith was his co-chair in 2008. So we're pulling some of the Joe Biden people. Got really big endorsements in New Hampshire, the top vote-getting alderman, president of the board of aldermen in Manchester, which is obviously the biggest city in the state. He's endorsed us and two others. So I'm doing it the old-fashioned way,
mm-hmm.
and I know that's not as sexy as getting on Twitter and having 8 million followers, but this is how I'm doing it, and you know, I think at the end of the day, it's going to pay off.
So give us your pitch then. Why is it that Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio thinks that I'm speaking in third person here. Why is it that you think you're the right person to serve in the White House?
Because I'm my agenda gets us out of the left and right conundrum that we're in right now and gets us in the new and better. And what progressives should hear when I say that is the new and better agenda is a progressive agenda, but it's new. I'm talking about trauma-informed care in our schools, social and emotional learning in every school, a mental health counselor in every school, vocational training in every school, art therapy, music therapy, play therapy. If we don't address the trauma that our kids are having, we're never going to get their brain to function properly. We've learned more about the brain in the last 20 years than the previous 200, and I want an agenda for our kids that actually deals with how their brain's functioning. So a progressive listening to this right now should say, wow, that's interesting, and that is the response I'm getting everywhere I go. When I talk about healthcare, we don't just talk about health insurance. My agenda is about how do we get healthy, not how do we pay for the insurance, mm-hmm. which, of course, everyone needs it, and I'm for it, and it should be affordable and accessible and quality, include mental health. But how do we get healthy? And how do we incentivize doctors and patients to get us healthy and keep us healthy with rebates and refunds for the patients, doctors getting a piece of the action if they get in, stay us, keep us healthy? And how do we use things like food as medicine to reverse chronic disease? Because 3/4 of our healthcare costs are chronic diseases that are largely preventable. So how do we build a system out that reverses type 2 diabetes using interventions like food as medicine mm-hmm. and other supports? No one's talking about this. And if we're going to be the party of the future, we need to implement the best knowledge that we have today and be the party of infusing this into our institutions right now and our systems that are broken. Same thing with agriculture. I'm the only candidate talking about a robust move from industrial agriculture to regenerative and sustainable agriculture. And we're going to be doing Facebook Lives with Gabe Brown and other regenerative farmers. I mean, check this out. These regenerative farmers are the only farmers in America making money because they don't have all the inputs. They don't have all the pesticides. They don't have the herbicides, the fungicides. They're building the soil. They're sequestering carbon, which is going to be a huge part of reversing climate change, is we've got to have the farmers involved. They're making money. They're not using as much fertilizer that goes into the rivers and then goes and creates the dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi River, which kills 220,000 metric tons of fish a year. Good, healthy protein, destroying the fishing industry down there and other places. So what I'm offering is new and better, but let me put the bow on this real quick for you for 15 seconds. Each one of these has the support of both Democrats and Republicans and libertarians. These farmers that are – some of them that are doing regenerative ag don't even think that climate change is caused by man. Who cares? Like, they want to sequester carbon and they want to use less pesticides and they want to use less fertilizer. So I want to – I am the Democrat who's saying, okay, there's a great issue that we all agree on. Let's move on it. And they don't need the farming subsidies. Mm. So we can reduce these subsidies and reinvest that money back into rural America.
So look, I love a detailed plan as much as anybody. And I appreciate hearing the details here now. But in the sort of rough and tumble of the primary process, mm-hmm. You're also selling a vision, right? Mm-hmm. Selling may not be the right word. You're trying to convince people that your vision is the right one for the country. Mm-hmm. And let's just take healthcare in isolation, for example. Yep. Totally hear you about there have to be innovative and new ways of thinking about how to create a system that values health, right? Yeah. Fundamentally, that's what you're saying.
Of course.
But there are millions of people out there right now who are saying, fine, happy to get there. I need insurance first.
Yeah.
Insurance that I can afford. And what I want right now is a big, bold plan that takes that quantum leap and puts America in amongst the other developed nations of the world and gets everybody covered. Why is it that you won't just directly support a Medicare for all system?
Well, I support universal coverage. I am on the Medicare for All bill, and I have been since 2007. I just don't think today that our step should be we are going to take private insurance or force people to get out of their private insurance. That's the only distinguishing factor, really, that I have with everyone else. Because I have a lot of people in Ohio, in mm-hmm. Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Western Pennsylvania who have really good health insurance.
Right.
There is zero trust with the political system today. So I think that it is a big mistake for us as a party, and I think it's bad policy, to go to those people and say, I know you've negotiated wages away in your union and in order to get really good health care. And I know there's an opiate epidemic in a lot of these communities. And I know there's sickness and deaths of despair and adverse childhood experiences and a lot of chronic disease. But you have health care right now. I don't think it's a good idea for us to go into those communities and say, I have a better idea for you. I'm going to take your health care and I'm going to give you a Washington, D.C. run health care plan. That is not a good idea.
Well, we had that same fight with the Affordable Care Act and the quote-unquote Cadillac healthcare plans. Yeah. I hear what you're saying. But ultimately, if indeed you still see the nation as wanting to head towards Medicare for all. You can't kick that can down the road forever, and you're going to have to ask those very same members of unions that you're talking about, whether it's, you know, in 2020 or 2024, 28. When you switch over to that Medicare for All plan, you're going to be asking them to give up the current health care plans they have. Are you saying that you can come up with a Medicare for All system that provides the same level of benefits and insurance that these union members have now so that perhaps the switch won't be as jarring?
Well, yeah, over time, and let them choose, like set up this alternative system. And let's be very clear. I voted for the Affordable Care Act. I voted for the Affordable Care Act in the House of Representatives with the public option. I've been out front on universal coverage and public options. I've been in Congress 17 years. And you can talk to anybody. I was out front. And I lost a lot of my colleagues from Ohio when we voted for the Affordable Care Act who put their careers on the line. So I don't take a backseat to anybody on universal coverage, making it affordable. I represent one of the poorest districts in the entire United States Congress. So I just want everybody to be very, very clear here. This isn't about some Republican light. And I know, like, if you're not, you don't pass all the litmus tests. Oh, my God, you're a Republican light. You're not a real Democrat. I've been on the front lines and in this battle for a long, long time. I'm just saying, here's an idea. Let's drop Medicare to 50. Okay, and let people buy into it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that covers a lot of people that I represent in these older industrial areas. Kaiser Permanente says that if you do that, 60 million Americans will see a 40% reduction in their healthcare costs. Set up a public option and allow small businesses to buy into Medicare too.
Well, when we come back, we got to take a quick break. We'll talk more about healthcare, the opioid epidemic, about gun control in America. We are talking with Congressman Tim Ryan. He's the congressman from Ohio's 13th district and a presidential hopeful. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking with Congressman Tim Ryan. He's a Democratic congressman from Ohio and a presidential candidate as well. And Congressman Ryan, I'm going to get some callers in here because we got a lot of people who want to talk to you, but you wanted to complete a thought about healthcare.
I just want to say, like, when you're talking about paying for all of this, you can't just dump the money into this broken healthcare system that we have now. The food is medicine. The reversing chronic diseases is really going to be critical to us. It's about $3.5 trillion a year in direct and indirect costs of chronic diseases that are largely preventable. So my point is we've got to get that number down so we could take that money, the savings, both in the private and public sector, and reinvest that back into covering people who you can't reverse their chronic diseases. So that is a key component of whatever we're talking about. That reform has got to be in place, new and better.
All right. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Litchfield, Kentucky. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, Meghna. My question is, as a military retiree, I have TRICARE. And if we transition everybody into a Medicare for All system, everybody is given something that they did not have to sacrifice anything to earn. So what would be or how would the congressman propose restoring value to my sacrifice as they basically give another benefit to all citizens?
Well, healthcare is a right, so we want to make sure that everybody has affordable, accessible, quality healthcare in the United States. And I'm kind of an old school guy. I've been in Congress 17 years. I was in the Ohio State Legislature for 2 years. we sit down and you actually have hearings on this stuff. Of course, we want to make sure that the veteran is rewarded for their sacrifice. Now, if there's a point where this coverage all becomes quality health care for everybody and you're not going to get a diminished health care, maybe there's another benefit that can accrue for veterans in some way. But let's sit down and go through the committee process and have experts and veterans organizations talk to us about how this is going to be affected, and unions at the table talking to us about how they would be affected. This has got to be done in a very thoughtful way.
Michael, thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Penny, who's calling from Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Penny, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Congressman, my question is, what is your answer to the opioid crisis in the United States, and why are the Democrats really not talking about this on the campaign trail or at the debates? There's 192 people every day dying from this. That's a lot of voters, the families of these people that are dying, and it's just not getting addressed enough. And what is your answer?
I appreciate that. I've been trying to talk about it as much as possible. My congressional district in Ohio, we are really at the epicenter of the opiate epidemic. We lost more people, I think, 2 years ago to overdoses than we did during the entire Vietnam War. So this is an issue that we're facing every single day where I live and where my kids are going to school. We need to, again, play offense with this. Part of it is, and it's got to be comprehensive, and we need resources behind it. We need about $10 billion a year, and it starts with prevention. It starts in our schools. It starts with social and emotional learning and these other things that help kids deal with the trauma that they're dealing with so they don't go down that road. And we have schools in my district where I was there last year. In one elementary school, seven parents died
from overdoses.
Wow. In one school. And then, you know, again, the trauma, the adverse childhood experiences that ripple from that just in that one school.
Yeah.
So we've got to make sure we're taking care of the kids. We've got to make sure there's proper treatment. We've got to make sure law enforcement, which is getting totally burnt out now, dealing with reviving people sometimes in the same night. We've got to make sure they have the resources that they need. But for me, the big focus has got to be on expanding the rehabilitation, the treatment that they need. Because in Ohio, for example, Medicaid will cover for 30 days. And that 30 days with drugs this powerful is not enough time. And so they'll send you back to 5 or 6 30-day treatments, but you're never really dealing with the problem. So we need to move to a system that's like 90 or 120 days paid for up front,
right,
as opposed to 5-30 days.
So resources
totally
underlies not just sort of the plans you have, but that every Democrat has, to be honest. Where are those resources going to come from? Are you going to roll back those tax cuts?
We have to. You know, when you look at CEOs have seen a 940% increase in their earnings over since 1978, and workers have only seen a 12% increase. Let me say that again, 940% increase to CEOs, 12% for the workers. So that concentration of wealth has to be taxed, and we need to get that revenue. But again, I don't want to put this money into a bunch of broken systems. Like, all these systems are broken, and so I'm not for just dumping money. And I talk about food as medicine. I talk about regenerative agriculture. I want to create and build new systems that we will tax people and then put the money in. So for me, again, it's like, okay, let's keep giving people 30-day rehabs, ask people to pay more in taxes so that we can keep doing this when the system isn't working. And when I talk about new and better, I'm talking about transforming systems, not reforming them, but transforming them into newer systems so that when we're at – I look at it like a school levy. Right. Everybody knows a school levy. What does the superintendent do? What does the school board do and the teachers and the coaches when they want to pass a school levy? They outline a plan on the reforms they're going to do to the school, or where they're going to allocate more money or less money, the cuts they're going to make, or whatever it is. And then you take that to the people and say, hey, will you vote for this tax increase on your property so that we can fund this school? I'm trying to do the same thing, is to say, look, here's my reforms for ag. Here's my reforms in education. Here's my reforms for healthcare. Now, wealthy people, we need your help. I mean, yeah. But I'm telling you, we're going to reform these systems.
So let's shift gears here a little bit, because I want to talk to you about guns in America. Obviously, we've had an ongoing spate of really terrible mass shootings in this country. As people probably know, you once had an A rating from the NRA.
Yeah.
For many, many years, in fact. And then in 2017, you returned a $20,000 donation from the NRA PAC. Or you gave it to sort of gun
gave
control.
Gave it to Evertown. And
include Sandy Hook Promise, yeah. Et cetera. And you've talked about how your evolution on your view of the NRA and guns more broadly in America. But what I want to know, Congressman, is that happened in 2017, mm-hmm. following the Las Vegas shooting. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you do it before? I mean, why did it take almost 500 people getting shot in one mass shooting, and you didn't have that same evolution for every other mass shooting that we had in the years prior to that? I mean, I'm thinking about the Sandy Hook shooting. You gave them money later. Why didn't you turn your back on the NRA after 26 babies essentially were murdered?
Yeah. Well, I did. I mean, my voting changed over time, starting with watching those things happen. You can go back and look at my votes in committee and the Appropriations Committee. So my voting changed. And then we were all hoping at some point, like, how is the NRA ever going to try to sit down and, like, do something, like, find some common ground on this? So my voting changed years and years and years before that. And then after Nevada, it was like, I wanted to help the groups that were doing the work, because I think building up the gun violence, anti-gun violence groups is really essential to combating the NRA. And I just had the idea, like, let me take the NRA money and, like, try to improve my own personal karma with, like, not getting rid of that money and then trying to do something good with it by helping the other group. So it wasn't an instant, like, transformation. It had been happening for years and years.
So this is one of those issues, though, why, I mean, you mentioned it before, because I hear your little sensitive to it about the accusation from some corners of the Democratic Party that you're a Republican light. Right? Or even Democratic light.
I'm not sensitive to it. I'm just acknowledging.
You're acknowledging. Okay. Well, I'm seeing, look, we're even getting comments here on Facebook from some of our listeners. Sean Dolan says you might fold and start taking money from the NRA as soon as lobbyists start waving money at you about it.
Yeah.
That's what he says.
That's fine. But that's not going to happen. I've been out front. I mean, I think in a lot of ways I represent a lot of Americans. I come from a state where the hunting culture is something that is important to everyone. The sportsman culture is important to everyone. I do a duck hunt every year, at least once a year, with our oldest son. You know, so I hunt. I'm not Annie Oakley, but it's part of our tradition. And so I came to Congress with, like, this general idea, like, okay, we want to protect the Second Amendment, right? Didn't give it a whole lot of thought. And then over time, I watched what happened. I experienced what was happening to our kids. I experienced with everybody else. I was like, okay, this is kind of crazy. Like, we've got to do something. And then my vote started to change. And then I kept watching it happen. And then, quite frankly, 6 years ago, I got married to a school teacher. Hmm. And she brought two kids in the marriage. And so now Mason and Bella are in schools. And then we had Brady. And Brady's 5 now. And he goes to school down the hall from where my wife teaches. And so, like, I just, you know, I don't know what to tell people. Like, I'm a human being that's 46 years old, and I don't believe the same thing I believed when I was 29. And if you want to hold me to some standard of when I got to Congress, to 17 years of experience and watching this stuff happen, I'm very passionate about getting these weapons of war off the street. I'm very passionate about the background checks. It sickens me to see what's happening to the country today, and to think that a few politicians like Mitch McConnell can block basic common sense gun legislation that 90% of the American people support. I would just assure everybody, you don't have to worry about me taking money from the NRA or anybody else. I'm passionate about these issues. I work very closely with the gun control groups.
Well, let's see if we can get another call in here. Juliet is calling from Rockport, Massachusetts. Juliet, you're on the air.
Well, thank you, Megan, a long-time listener, first-time caller.
And welcome.
I prompted a call because of Congressman Tim Ryan, as I've been listening to him for the past year when he appeared on C-SPAN and Washington Journal, and about 3 months ago he was on the C-SPAN for the Politics and Eggs breakfast they have in New Hampshire. And he spoke for a full 45 minutes, and he just resonates incredibly well with, I think, what would be the independent or swing voter in this country who, let's face it, are the constituent block of voters who really do turn the presidential election. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, your far right, your far left, and you have some margins, but I think, Mr. Ryan, you can really appeal to those swing voters. So what is your operation on the ground in all these key swing states, and how can you get your message out there? Because you're not being afforded, other than this particular venue you're on now, the voice, if you will.
So, Juliet, let me take that back from you, and thank you so much for your call. So let me just actually dovetail with something that Juliet's asking you about. Really, she's saying, like, how are you going to appeal to those swing voters, which I suppose that'd be a big question in the general, if you get there. But I was looking at the 2016 voting results in your congressional district. Mm-hmm. You won handily in 2016. But there were three counties in Ohio's 13th, Stark, Trumbull, and Portage County, who voted for President Trump.
Yeah.
So think about those voters in particular. How
I
are you?
I do.
Which you do. But so you know them very well. Yeah. How would you are you going to appeal to people like them?
Yeah. Well, let me first thank the caller.
Juliet,
I really appreciate it. Thanks for the help. If people do want to help, timryanforamerica.com. We obviously need money and we need support on the ground. So you can go to my website and help out. I think what that woman said is what I'm feeling on the ground. And I just need time to build that out. And so go to timryanforamerica.com. Help me get enough resources to keep this thing going, because that is what I'm feeling when I'm on the ground. And those are the people that say, this guy's interesting, because I think he espouses our progressive values, but he also can win in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Western Pennsylvania, or in Michigan. And so that's impressive. So anyway, I need your help. To do this and to speak to those voters, I think a lot of it is around getting out of the left-right divide. I think that's what Trump that was Trump's appeal. I mean, it's hard to picture him 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago, Donald Trump. He was saying, I'm going to raise taxes on the wealthy. I'm going to expand health care. I'm going to do a big infrastructure bill. And I'm rich and a great business person, so I can get this done. And I don't take anybody's money, so I'm not going to be bought and paid for. So the person in these industrial states, the white people, went and said, well, both parties have screwed me for the last 30 or 40 years. CEOs are getting 940% more than they were getting, and I'm getting 12% more. So what do I have to lose? I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. And Donald Trump spoke to that economic anxiety. And to me, that's what we have to speak to. We have to speak to that anxiety, that stress, that these systems are broken. And so that's what I'm talking about. And that's how we appeal to him. So white people went and voted for him, some. And black people stayed home because we weren't talking directly to their economic issues. And so
you're saying that they didn't turn out in the same numbers they did for President Obama.
For Barack Obama. Yeah, they stayed home. And I mean, that's statistically verifiable. And so what I can do is I have strong support in the African American community. I always have. They're some of my highest vote getting precincts. And so but I can also pull some of those working class people back, because Trump has lied on every one of these issues. And he was in my area just a year and a half ago saying, don't sell your house. And since then, we lost two shifts at the General Motors plant. So there's not a better person in this race to dog Donald Trump on economic issues than I am, because he lied to my folks back in Ohio. And I can make sure that these economic arguments are made directly. And I tease people all the time. I'm Irish, so I'm okay with getting in a little bit of a fight. And I think I could make that joke here in Boston. The old Irish saying, is this a private fight or can anyone get into it? Like, I'm ready to go against this guy. I've been in Congress 17 years. I've represented this district. And I think the other thing about my candidacy that's interesting is I'm talking about the new economy. I'm talking about building electric vehicles, building batteries, building charging stations, building solar, building wind. Right now, and this is what I will hit Trump on hard, China dominates 50 to 60% of the electric vehicle market. They dominate 60% of the solar market. And so this new economy stuff that I've been working on in Youngstown and Akron, Ohio, my entire career, we have one of the preeminent additive manufacturing centers in Youngstown, yeah. Ohio. I know the new economy. I know about the skills gap. And that's the argument that we're going to make to win and beat Donald Trump.
Well, Tim Ryan, Congressman from Ohio and Democratic presidential hopeful, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about Hong Kong protesters and how they're trying to fight facial recognition technology. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmanning, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The people of Hong Kong continue their massive protests. Yesterday, 1.7 million people were in the streets in peaceful protests, organizers say. Meanwhile, there's a technology story that's also playing out alongside the politics. Cameras are everywhere in the streets of Hong Kong, and they use facial recognition technology to record who is on the streets. Well, protesters have been trying to thwart that surveillance, and they're using some pretty low-tech methods, masks, goggles, and blinding the cameras using lasers. But there are some high-tech methods in the works, too, and we want to explore that now. And you can join us. What's your question about facial recognition technology and how law enforcement uses it? Are you concerned about it? Do you think it's time to push back? And joining us today from London is Tom Standage. He's deputy editor and former technology editor at The Economist. He's also co-host of the podcast The Secret History of the Future. The Economist recently published a story headlined "Fooling Big Brother: As Face Recognition Technology Spreads, So Do Ideas for Subverting It." And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hello. Good to be here.
So first of all, tell us about some of the more about the low-tech methods that Hong Kong protesters are using to fool the cameras that are watching them.
Sure. So if you look at pictures and video from the protests in Hong Kong, you can see that a lot of people are wearing yellow hard hats, but they're also wearing ski goggles or swimming goggles or scarves, or very often a combination of the two, or masks over their faces. And generally, they're just trying to make sure that if you get that it's impossible to get a clear view of their face. So that I think what they're concerned about not so much is not so much the use of facial recognition systems now. There are cameras around. I think they're worried that this is something that could be used against them in the future, because there are clearly police taking lots of high-resolution pictures. And what happened with the previous round of protests called the Umbrella Revolution a few years ago is that when all the protests have subsided, many of the leaders of that movement were subsequently arrested. And so this is a way of ensuring that participation in these protests now can't be used to track them down later, I think.
And this is, in fact, the same concern that people in other nations have about the creeping use of facial recognition technology, right? I mean, to your point, cameras are already everywhere. The question is, what will law enforcement do with it? I mean, if one day you're peacefully protesting and exercising your rights to free expression, but then you know, a year later you get arrested for some kind of activity, that's because your face has been identified and stored in government databases, right?
Well, that exactly. This is a concern that is it's not just limited to Hong Kong. We have a big debate about this going on in Britain at the moment. It turns out that a few police forces have been testing facial recognition in public, and a lot of people think they shouldn't have been allowed to do that because they haven't got consent from people. There's obviously a big debate about this in the U.S., where we see several cities saying they're going to ban it. We see employees at big tech companies saying we don't want the technology that the company we work for is producing to be used by repressive regimes. We see repressive regimes around the world looking at what China is doing in the west of China in Xinjiang, where it's using facial recognition to monitor the Uyghur people and saying, oh, look, China's obviously got some very good technology for keeping people in their place, and we would like some of that too. So we see interest from that in places like Egypt. So, yes, there's a big debate going on both in democracies and in more autocratic countries about what the appropriate use of this technology is.
And regarding the U.S. cities, thinking specifically of San Francisco and Oakland, saying they're going to forbid law enforcement for the time being from using this technology. So there's a big sort of policy-related question about what governments and agencies should be allowed to do, how long they should be allowed to keep these images, etc. But I also want to talk with you, Tom, about what The Economist has written about, that there's sort of this growing movement of people trying to find high and low-tech ways to thwart it. Now, first of all, this technology has gotten very, very good, right? Accuracy rates in the 98% to 99%.
Yes, you have to be a little bit careful with the numbers because the numbers refer to different things. So, if you get an image of a person and then you take a picture of them with a camera and you ask a human whether it's the same person, humans get that right about 98% of the time. And machines can now get that right. This is a one-to-one comparison. Are these two pictures of the same person? Machines can now, the best ones, the best algorithms, can get this right about 99.8% of the time. And in fact, there's an annual competition. Actually, I'm not sure it's annual anymore, but there's a quite regularly hosted competition called Megaface, which is like the Olympics of facial recognition. And essentially, all of the different algorithms that have been devised by the big American tech companies, by the Chinese, by the Russians, they all have this big competition. And so that's one of the different contests there, which is, are these two people the same? How accurate are you? Another round of the contest is, here's a picture and here's a database of 1 million people. Can you find the right person in that database? And that, for that kind of task, these systems, at their best, they're now only right about 80% of the time. So if you use a system like that and you're watching people going into a ball game or something, and you're comparing people who walk past against a big database, then you're going to get a lot more false matches. And so that's why it's a bit dangerous to talk about, these things are 99.8% accurate versus, anything else, because the statistics depend very much on whether you're doing a one-to-many lookup or a one-to-one comparison.
No, I appreciate you make that point, and let's just buttress it a little bit and say, and also the accuracy drops the darker your skin tone gets. I mean, that's also an issue.
There is an issue that these systems have been trained using data sets that are not very diverse. And so they're much less accurate when it comes to recognizing non-white people. And there have been various efforts to fix that. But then those efforts themselves have run into controversy because a lot of them were basically, the way you build a more diverse database is by just stealing images off the internet. So there was a bit of a kerfuffle about that too. And in fact, if you look, I've been following this field for several years, and there's been just one controversy after another. There was an app in Russia called Find Face, and essentially the Russian equivalent of Facebook, which is called VKontakte, allows, although you can have a private profile, your profile images are all public. So it was quite easy for the developers of that app to scrape the images of 100 million Russians and then build an app that literally lets you point your phone at somebody in a bar or on a train and say, who is this? And it will very often, it'll very quickly get you to the right person. Mm-hmm. And they claim this is a dating app, and that it's so that if you see someone you like the look of in a bar, you can send them a message. And that sounds very creepy to me. But then, of course, they also licensed the technology to the police, and they started to use it, with CCTV footage, who's this, and so on and so on. So these different uses all blur into each other, but it also reminds you that when you, it's not just about, is your face visible in public, it's is your face visible on the internet as well. Yeah. And I think the scary thing behind all of this is the fact that the combination of very high-resolution cameras, you can take a picture of a crowd now with a high-res camera, and you can make what's called a gigapixel image. It's where you take a picture of, you know, 100,000 people gathering somewhere, and you can zoom in on any individual face and see it very sharply. And you can take pictures with drones, and we've seen those being used in Hong Kong as well. So it's this. Basically, this is eroding freedom of association, because you can go to a protest, someone can take your picture. Years later, perhaps, an authoritarian government takes control in your country, and they say, right, we're going to round up all the people who went to that protest. And so you can then be, you can be found, you know, years later. And that's, I think, what's kind of, that's what is foremost in the minds of the Hong Kong protesters who are covering up their faces. Mm-hmm. In theory, Hong Kong gets handed, becomes a full part of the Chinese legal system and becomes like the rest of China in 2047, but China obviously wants that to happen a bit sooner.
Well, so Tom, let's talk then about the other methods. I'm going to fulfill my promise to listeners here.
Of course,
because they're fascinating, right? I mean, as good as the technology is getting, machine vision is different than human vision. So researchers and artists are coming up with some pretty low-tech ways to thwart the facial recognition technology. I mean, first of all, tell us a little bit about, for example, Adam Harvey. He's an American artist and researcher who created something called computer vision Dazzle. Like, even just doing makeup differently on your face can be
exactly, yeah. So Dazzle makeup is the kind of geometric patterns that were painted on warships, and it's a very kind of, it's a good look, actually. in fact, a friend of mine, his Twitter profile picture is him wearing this Dazzle makeup. But essentially, it's very kind of bright geometric patterns, a bit like, you know, what people have in The Lion King or something like that. And what that does is it throws off the facial recognition system, because it's expecting a shape to have, you know, two eyes and a nose and a mouth kind of in fairly predictable positions relative to each other, and it's not expecting these big squiggles that are a completely different color. So he developed that as a way to do it. Now, the thing about it is it's very obvious that you're wearing it. And it's the same with, you know, if you wear a ski mask and there's a Japanese
right.
system that is a kind of funny set of patterned sunglasses, and you kind of look like it is like you're out of a sci-fi movie or something. So there have been various sort of low-tech things like that. So the guy who developed Dazzle has moved on to a slightly more subtle approach called Hyperface, and this is Adam Harvey again, and he's at New York University. And Hyperface is where you fool the cameras in a slightly different way by wearing patterns on your clothes that have essentially blobs that look sort of vaguely face-like. So you've got sort of two eyes or two blobs with another blob in the middle and then another long blob underneath. And so that throws off the vision system, because it sees what appear to be lots and lots and lots of faces all over your clothes, and it can't figure out which is your actual face. You've got the drawback with that is it's very obvious you're wearing a thing that is designed to subvert.
Beyond just making a fashion statement.
So
I take your point. Like, these efforts, it's obvious that you're trying to thwart a system here. But there's The Economist has written about other things like a baseball cap that's simply fitted with infrared LEDs, and that isn't, and they sort of shine a LED pattern on your face or an infrared pattern on your face, and that's enough to thwart
Exactly. It's really clever. And it's because the cameras that facial recognition systems use don't work the same way as the human eye, and they can see into the infrared. So that's a kind of light that we can't see, but it's the kind of light that is used, for example, when you unlock an iPhone with Face ID, it's actually shining a grid of LED, of infrared lights on your face to map the shape of your face. So essentially, they're using a similar trick here, and they have a baseball cap, and there are tiny light emitting diodes underneath the peak of the cap, and they shine light onto your face. So they light up your face in a way that can't be seen by humans, but changes the way that your face looks to a camera that is being used for facial recognition. So firstly, they used this to show that they could just completely fool the camera, so they didn't realize that it was looking at a face at all. And then they realized that by fiddling exactly how the illumination of the face is done with this invisible infrared light, they could fool FaceNet, which is one of the big facial recognition algorithms, into thinking that one person was another person. So this is a very clever trick, because there's no outward evidence to, you know, if you're going to a protest, the police can't tell that you've got a system on your head that's thwarting a facial recognition system, but actually you have.
Well, let's take a quick call here. Marina is calling from Auburn, Alabama. Marina, you're on the air.
Hi there. I was wondering if there has been any notable legal success globally in persons trying to pursue action against some of these violations of facial recognition.
Well, thanks for your call, Marina. Tom, any successes in courts of law around the world pushing back against facial recognition technology?
That's a good question. Not that I know of. Instead, it's been sort of efforts. So there have been lobby groups in Britain saying, and I think some experimental use by the police is they've now said they're not going to proceed with that. But I don't know that it's got to the point where people have said I've been, you know, wrongly identified using this technology. There was a case in Britain where somebody was walking past a police van that was testing a facial recognition system. He had a scarf on, and they said, you have to take the scarf off. And he said, why? And they said, because we're scanning everyone with this new system. And
right.
He said, well, I don't want to be scanned by it. And he ended up getting into an argument with the police and fined, but he was fined for using threatening language against the policeman rather than, you know, refusing to cooperate with the facial recognition system. So I think we really are in a situation where the law around this is all quite fluid, and I think it's good that we're having this debate and we're talking about it, because this is something that does change, you know, our ability to be anonymous in public in ways that people might not realize. And they may not care about it now, but they may care about it in the future if the government in their country changes.
Well, let's listen to a little bit about how that debate is playing out in the United States, because, for example, in May, the House Oversight and Reform Committee held hearings on the use of facial recognition technology by government and business. I mean, business is a big part of this. Here, Nima Singh Gulia of the ACLU explains to Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan that the FBI probably already knows who you are and what you look like.
So the FBI has massive databases, and they use external partners as well. So one of the things they do is they use state driver's license databases. I think, you know, up to 18 states have been reportedly used by the FBI. They use passport photos.
So my question is, did the state legislature and the governor actually pass legislation saying it was okay for the FBI to access every single person in their state who has a driver's license?
No, and that's the problem. This was all in secret.
That's from a House Oversight Reform Committee hearing held in May. Tom Standage, you know, the argument for, in the law enforcement and government context, for using facial recognition technology is, of course, one of safety, right? The TSA here in the United States is launching pilot programs in many airports, saying, like, your face will be scanned as you board an airplane. There's an opt-out provision for that. I'm not sure many people know that, but you can opt out of it. But ultimately, the idea is safety and giving law enforcement another tool to do their jobs to protect the public. I mean, how law enforcement must see these efforts, high tech and low tech, to thwart that facial recognition technology is problematic, no?
Yeah, well, I don't think we should lump in all uses of facial recognition the same way, because there are ways it can be useful and people can give their consent and they can say, actually, I'm happy to do this. You know, and obviously when I'm doing something like going through passport control, it's important that either a human or a machine can see my face and match it with the face in my passport. And it's much more convenient when I'm going through an airport if, you know, there are shorter queues because they're using a machine to do that. So in that situation, that's one thing. And we see very often that, you know, people will put aside concerns they might have about privacy,
yeah,
if they get some convenience out of it. Now, in this case, I don't think it's unreasonable that you can look at the faces of people going through passport control.
We've got just a couple of seconds, Tom.
Yeah, well, the Hong Kong protesters are worried about something else. That's the thing. They're worried about lack of consent. They're worried about they don't know what's being done with these pictures. And they're worried about the political implications of what might happen in the future.
Well, Tom Standage, deputy editor and former technology editor at The Economist, thank you so much. This is On Point.